Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Hey everyone, thanks so much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. You know, sometimes you listen to people and you get a sense that, you know, they just don't know what I'm going through. They've never done what I do, and you're coming up on this transition, this succession plan. You're thinking about, you know, in the next few years, I need to do something that's going to be scary. I'm going to try to sell my business, my baby. And so today we're going to talk to someone who's done it and done it and done it again. And now he's come over to the planning side to help you business owners understand what you need to know so that you can have a successful transition and to help build the value of your business so you're attractive to a buyer. My guest today is John Warlow. He's the founder and president of the Value Builder System in Toronto, Ontario. And John has built and sold 4 businesses, and now he has developed something called the Value Builder System, which is a statistically proven methodology for increasing the value of a business by up to 71%. Now, the proven system is 100% advisor-led, meaning the only way that you, an entrepreneur, can leverage the methodology is through the support of a certified Value Builder. We're going to cover a lot of ground today. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Hey, John, we always like to give our listeners a chance to kind of get to know our guests a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about you and your background before we launch into the Value Builder System?
Well, I mean, I think you did a great job in the introduction. I've been building businesses for about 20 years. I'm certifiably unemployable, so I can't do that. So I chose entrepreneurship as a career, I guess, about 20 years ago. And have been building companies. I wrote a book called Built to Sell back in 2011, which kind of became a bit of a launching pad for the current business I'm in. It was written after I'd gone through 4 businesses, learned and made every mistake in the book about, in particular, what drives company value. And so I tried to codify that in the book. And I guess, as you said in the intro, just sort of having gone through it a couple times, found that you know, there's a ton of different, you Google like starting a company, there's just, you could spend your entire lifetime reading, but you try to find really good quality information about the exit process, and there's a dearth of good information. So we're kind of trying to fill that gap.
You're right. The planning community is really, especially in the U.S. and the government agencies like the Small Business Administration, they're really trying to help people start and grow and run small businesses, and they've kind of lost sight of the fact that a huge number of business owners are baby boomers, and they're heading for their sunset years, and they're wondering how the heck they're going to get out of it. So, and the concept of growing the value of a business is pretty universal. It's not just for people that are exiting a business. Anybody who runs a business should be excited about this topic, right?
You're right. And I think there's a big sort of misunderstanding about what drives company value, because a lot of these CEOs and founders I talk to really focus on top line revenue growth at really the expense of everything else, right? So they just go to bed at night assuming that as long as we're bigger next month, next year than we are now, we're growing company value. And while that, you know, is true to some extent, there are lots of examples where big companies get really low multiples and really little companies get really big multiples. And so I just think it's kind of simplistic to say, well, as long as we're growing, you know, we're building our value. I think we've seen enough examples where that's actually not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of business owners, you know, they hear their friends boast about what their business sold for, and they think my business must be worth that. But the beauty of the Value Builder system and program is it brings business owners back down to earth as far as, you know, not so fast. You have some work to do, but it's okay. We've sectioned it out and parceled it out into 8 key value driver areas. And everybody I've shown this information to really loves the fact that now they can get their hands around and their head around what they need to do. So there are 8 key value driver areas within the Value Builder system. John, what are some of the most commonly low-scoring areas in the Value Builder report? Let's start with those.
Probably recurring revenue is the lowest scoring one of all 8, and interestingly, one of the most important. So when you go to exit your business, whether you're going to, you know, sell it or pass it down, what anybody's going to want to know is, okay, how does this business continue to thrive when you, the owner, the rainmaker, the kind of front guy or gal, leave? And so the more recurring revenue you can have, the more valuable the business is going to be to an acquirer. So, you know, we've codified these 9 different subscription models, but you don't have to be a software company. I mean, we're all buying software now as a service, right? And we're used to that cloud-based software. But we wrote, you know, these 9 models to identify that you don't have to be software. You can be in retail, distribution, manufacturing, you know, services to create some recurring revenue. And I think that's a real missing link for a lot of folks, that they need to get some annuity revenue before they go to sell.
And a lot of people really need to put their creative thinking hats on to come up with something that I've talked to. But, for instance, I just bought a new printer from a big giant printer manufacturer, and all of a sudden now they're selling me a subscription to get ink delivered on a regular basis as soon as it gets. So everybody's thinking this way about recurring revenue, but it seems like this is a new phenomenon, but it's really not. It's just that a lot of people are now paying more attention to this. Is that true?
You bet. I mean, our great, great, great grandmothers and fathers used to get coal delivered, right? And our great grandmothers used to get milk delivered, right? And on a subscription. So the subscription model has been around for hundreds of years. There's nothing new about the subscription model. What I think has sort of accelerated over the last few years is, to your point, the breadth of things that you can now buy on subscription. I'll give you an example. I love the HP printer example, by the way. I think it's great. Good B2B example. It makes you, because you subscribe to the ink refills at whatever, $10 a month, you become much more likely to buy another HP printer, by the way, which is the reason they do it. Another example, sort of in a similar vein, that I love is H Bloom. These guys sell flowers on subscription. So, you know, typical flower store throws out most of its inventory every month because it rots in the fridge. They've got to buy rent really expensive real estate because they're trying to intercept somebody, you know, before they go home from work to get them to buy flowers. And what H Bloom does is they go to people who buy flowers on a recurring basis. So the hotels and the spas that want flowers on their desktop. And so they say, look, we'll sell you a subscription to flowers. And because they buy them regularly anyways, it just takes another thing off their plate. And H. Bloom read recently their lifetime value of an average subscriber is over $4,000. So you make one sale to one hotel and you've got $4,000 of lifetime value.
Wow. And that's really what a lot of people are looking at is these days is who do you have that is a repeat buyer subscriber? And companies are paying huge multiples for that because it boils down to that understanding of the value of a client, the long-term value of a client, not the value of a single sale. What's the value of a long-term client, and how can we make that predictable?
Yeah, I'll give you another example. Absolutely right. Give you another example. A guy named Steve Huey, I interviewed him this week for my podcast. He runs a company called The Learning House, or ran until he sold it. $8 million in revenue, right? And from colleges and students who buy courses on a recurring basis, it's 100% recurring. He got an offer from a private equity company of 4x top line revenue. You and I are used to talking about 4x EBITDA, right? 4x profit. He's getting 4x revenue because 100% of his source of revenue is coming from recurring sources. And that's from a PE firm, generally, you know, bottom feeders of the acquisition market. They generally pay much less than a corporate buyer would. But again, it comes back to, in that case, the attractiveness of the recurring revenue.
That's substantial. What's another area that you see that scores low in the Value Builder reports that you see?
Yeah, so we tend to get low scores or see low scores from the Switzerland structure. So the Switzerland structure is one of the eight attributes. The name comes from the country of Switzerland, where, you know, they're kind of obsessed with independence. We give it the name because the companies that do well on the score are independent of any one customer, employee, or supplier. Said another way, they are not dependent on a single customer, so there's not a lot of customer concentration. They're not dependent on a single employee, so they don't have one, you know, key salesperson that drives 80% of their revenue, for example. And they're also not really deeply dependent on a single supplier. And so you want to be nimble enough so that you could swap out any one of those, you know, the no customer, for example, should represent more than, you know, 10 or 15% of your revenue. No employee should be kind of completely indispensable. So that's another one we see that companies often score quite low on.
And from the employee standpoint, that really begs that the employer, the owner, work hard on developing processes and systems and descriptions of how jobs are done so that they have kind of this, I always tell people, it's kind of this franchise manual, you know, that they can plop down on the table and say, here's how we do things around here. It's all documented. So that way, if that key employee leaves, they're not stuck wondering, well, now what do we do?
You're absolutely right. I mean, Michael Gerber wrote the book on this. What it was 30 years ago, it's become kind of the go-to guide for any startup ever. It was a great book, and it documents exactly what you're talking about, this idea of systematizing so that you could swap out employee A for employee B, and they could follow the process, right? So it's there's also lots of software emerging these days that allow you to create these sort of, you know, employee manuals online so that everybody can access them kind of remotely. So that's another approach that we're seeing more recently, for sure.
We know one of the areas in the Value Builder score that really intrigues me is the one called monopoly control. Can you address that one?
Well, yeah, it refers to, you know, the name comes from Warren Buffett. As you know, he's famous for saying that we invest at Berkshire Hathaway in companies that have a deep and wide moat, right, competitive moat. And the reason they do that, obviously, is because they think that because there's a competitive moat, they're going to have pricing authority, right? The company can charge to some extent what it wants, or at least a premium, and then it, you know, creates this sort of, you know, domino effect where there's more money to be invested in sales and marketing, better margins, and so forth. So he's looking for companies with a differentiated value proposition. So what makes you really unique in the market? And again, from what I've experienced, a lot of smaller companies have grown up in business thinking that their location is what makes them unique. So we're like, you know, we're the third biggest swimming pool installation company in Orange County, as an example. Mm-hmm. Proximity, to some extent, it works, but it's becoming neutralized, of course, the value of it, with the internet, right? Where people can buy their chlorine pucks for their hot tub now on Amazon.com. They don't have to go to the swimming pool store. And so it's becoming less important to lead with "we're the local guys," and more important to come up with something that makes you truly unique. Because acquirers, of course, built by companies that they couldn't easily replicate. If you've got a commodity business and all you're doing is bottom feeding and selling for the lowest price, well, a buyer, if you think about it, a buyer can basically replicate what you're doing by just lowering the price below cost for a few months, capture your entire market share, and then not have to buy your business. And so what you're really trying to do is build something that is very difficult to replicate, which is when acquirers actually buy businesses as opposed to choose to compete with you.
Interesting. Okay, and that's, of course, that is a mindset that people can get into 5 years before they exit their businesses, starting to say, where can we be a jewel among rocks, if you will, on the beach, so that a strategic buyer will come along and say, boy, we have to have you guys, and we'll pay top dollar because you're unique, you do it better than anybody else, and it would be very, very difficult for us to beat you in that space.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, you raise a really interesting point as well, which is the getting ahead of the curve and planning this stuff early. I interviewed a guy for my podcast named Michael Glazer who made this mistake in sort of building a company and not knowing what he was trying to do or how he was going to exit. He built an ice cream company and he built retail stores, 60 of them, and all the headaches associated with hiring part-time employees, like all you can think about, all the mess associated with 60 different, you know, locations. At the same time, he also sold his ice cream through big box retailers, Sobeys and Kroger's and stuff like that. And when he went to sell his business, the guys who wanted to buy his business, all of them to a letter, had no interest in the stores. All they cared about was the distribution into Kroger and the other big supermarkets. And so they bought his business for a relatively low multiple because they didn't value the 60 stores. So they essentially just shut down the 60 stores when they acquired the company. And they had, and Michael had to sell his business for a relatively low multiple, again, because he didn't know what the exit looked like before he started. He didn't know who the buyers would be, and he didn't think through what the buyer value proposition. And when I say buyer, I'm not talking about customer. I'm talking about acquirer. I think you want to think about what is the value proposition for the acquirer long before you want to sell it. And that's going to help you decide, in Michael's case, not to start retail stores and not to divert all that capital and headache to 60 different stores that no one's going to value.
Wow. Big lesson to learn there. And, in your book, Built to Sell, which I quote the theme of the book to somebody at least once a week, because I work with so many service businesses, because, of course, that's what we're, that's the bulk of the businesses around us. But so many of them are wondering, how the heck am I ever going to sell this crazy one-off, every day is a one-off order or change order type of a business. And the book Built to Sell is a fascinating read, and it basically says that it starts with a model of a service. It follows a service company and talks about how that person had to transform that into something that could be sellable by turning it into more of a product type of a company. What can service businesses do when they say, what I do just can't be it can't be turned into a product? Is it just take more thinking?
Well, yeah, it maybe takes a different lens or a different hat in your brainstorming. Essentially, the overriding theme on what makes a sellable company, regardless of what industry they're in, is how is this company going to perform without the owner? And most service businesses become deeply dependent on the owner because the owner's the subject matter expert, right? Like if it's a swimming pool service company, they're the ones who dig the best pools. If it's an electrician, they're the ones who do the complicated jobs. And so what as a business owner, I think you need to do is figure out of all the services that you provide today, put them up on a whiteboard and start to think about which ones can be done without you personally overseeing them. And I use a sort of a trifecta of scale. It's a lens through which we look at businesses against these three criteria. They've got to be, the service that you're providing has got to be teachable to employees, valuable to customers, and repeatable. So teachable is, can you teach employees to do it? Valuable is this a commodity? Or is this something that is uniquely required or requested from your customers? You're looking for something that's really unique. And then repeatable means on what cadence do people buy this? Is this a coffin that they only need once, or a wedding ring you only buy once? Or is this something that you buy on a regular cadence? And so I would look at all of your services, plot them out, give them a score of 1 to 10 on each of these three attributes, and then try to isolate the highest scoring services, because those are the ones that have the best likelihood to be able to be extracted from you personally, and ones that you could actually sort of build a business around, not dependent on you personally.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating read. If you have not had a chance to read the book, it's Built to Sell. It's available, of course, on Amazon, anywhere you buy books. And, John, go back to the Value Builder Score. Now, you've done thousands of these Value Builder Scores now through all of your advisor.
Yeah, 25,000.
That's a lot. Okay, so that's big enough to see, spot some trends. What do you think is the overall experience you've heard of business owners who took these areas? They took the Value Builder Score. They realized, okay, we have some areas that we score lowly in. Let's work on those. And they've worked on them over a period of a year. What do you think is their overall experience? What have you heard?
What we've heard is the very act of answering the questions makes them think differently. Because the questions themselves are multiple choice questions. So it's not open-ended stuff where you're encouraged to do free form. You're given four answers, and you have to pick the one that is most applicable to your situation or most describes you. And in just going through, it takes about 15 minutes to complete the questionnaire, and just going through it, I think it reveals some things about the way you think about your business. And it can often reveal this, again, this what I see is this sort of default mentality, which is, you know, my company is determined, the value of my company is determined by its industry and its size. So we're an HVAC company, and therefore we're going to trade at 1x revenue. Well, we've seen, again, examples where companies trade at double the industry average and less than half. And the reason for that is nothing to do with the industry and everything to do with how they're running the business. I mean, you look at the valuation of Uber today, right? I mean, they're not $80 billion or something like that. It's not being valued based on Uber's profits. If you look at, you know, recently the acquisition of Marriott bought Starwood, billions of dollars in acquisition value. It wasn't, you know, they weren't buying bricks and mortar real estate. They were buying the Starwood Preferred Guest program and all the loyalty that it engenders. And so, again, I think going through the questionnaire will help you realize what are the things that buyers are going to want to, you know, look at in your business. And it goes beyond just, you know, what industry you're in, what revenue you have.
It really does. I mean, this information is fascinating. It helps people to not only understand some things about their business, but it also, the report that comes along with it helps them to, I think, and I've told a lot of people this, and I've heard this from a lot of people, it helps them to have better conversations when they're working on their business with their key employees and their managers of their company. Because each section has some questions that they can say, okay, we scored low in this area. Let's have conversations about this instead of the usual conversations that most business owners have with their managers, which is what fires do we need to put out today and, you know, what's happening in the next week. So it helps them to look longer. You've done some studies on this, John, about how much somebody can increase their score from, say, the average when they come in, the averages when they come in, to working on this over a period of time and working on each of these modules. How much does it increase the value of a business on average?
Yeah, so again, as you mentioned earlier, we've had 25,000 business owners go through this questionnaire, and the average score, by the way, out of 100 is 59. So that's the average. And the average multiple companies have received that have gone through the questionnaire is 3.6x their pre-tax profit. So, you know, round numbers here, if you've got a business churning out $1 million of pre-tax profit, the average business in our study would be selling for, if it was $1 million profit business, 3.6x $1 million, or $3.6 million. For those businesses, again, it's a relatively small subset that achieve a score of 80 or greater on the Value Builder questionnaire. Those businesses are trading at an average multiple of 6.1x pre-tax profit, or almost double the average scoring business. And again, that's going to beg the question for most people, okay, well, what drives the Value Builder score? That's what I want to focus on. Those are the eight things we've been talking about today: recurring revenue, Switzerland structure, monopoly control, those things that the business owners can focus on beyond their revenue that will drive up the value of their company.
And what I particularly like about what you've put together is that, you know, business owners, we all know they don't have much time. You know, they're busy. They're that's the problem. They're too busy running their business. They need to be working on their business. And so you've sectioned this out into bite-sized modules that they can work on these segmented areas over the course of a year, one a month for a couple hours a month. And how did you come up with that idea? What's the story behind how you came up with this, the Value Builder system, John?
You know, so I've got kids at home, and they're a little older now, but when they were really young, they were obsessed with Lego. Like every birthday, every Christmas, the only thing they wanted was Lego. And of course, you know, when you're a parent, right, you start buying the Lego age 2 to 4, and it's pretty easy. You can see, you sort of put it together in a couple minutes. And then by the time they get to like 8 or 9, the Lego comes like 5,000 pieces. And
oh, yeah.
Like lay them all out over the carpet. And it's like a weekend worth project to get the thing assembled. And you look at all the pieces and you think, there's no way this is all going to go together. But if you sort of follow the steps and you do one thing after the next, it eventually does. So
it
was my kids, but you know, that was the sort of vision that we had in building, you know, the 12 steps in the Value Builder system is let's make this Lego block. So like, you know, don't overthink it. Don't get overwhelmed with the complexity of this. Just do one, module a month and sort of build on them, right? So one module locks into this next module. And so that was the sort of thinking behind making it, you know, very specific methodology with 12 unique steps, one building on the next.
That's a great story. Of course, I always get those Lego kits and I'm like, I can't wait to build this. Like, you know, by step six, my son is off like doing something else and I'm the warrior putting it together.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to super glue them together so they couldn't tear them apart too. But so let me ask you a question. That's a great story. And that is exactly how this thing's laid out. It's step one, step two, step three. So you don't have to get, you know, so many things that business owners get approached with are overwhelming to them. And they go, I don't have time to try to understand all this. This is a program that they can go through step by step. What do you think the biggest mistakes owners make is in approaching their exit?
Well, I mean, my knee-jerk reaction to that question, Bill, would be to, you know, the one that you raised in your opening comments, which is that we don't think about it early enough. You know, so many of us, you know, kind of just put it off, right? But it always sort of 5 years out, right? I'm going to sell in 5 years. You go meet the guy in 5 years. Oh yeah, I'm you know, 5 years from now I'm going to sell. And that's just, they're kind of permanently in this sort of this deferral mentality. And you know, eventually, so many of us, you know, ride our businesses over the top. What I mean by that is they get, you know, you're past your sell-by date. Either the market changes, technology overwhelms you, or physically you become, you know, less of the entrepreneur that you were for whatever reason. You age and you're not able to kind of, and then it's very difficult to sell for a premium when you're on the backside of your growth curve, right? When you're kind of declining. In fact, it's, you know, you usually get deeply discounted. And so, you know, I'm a big believer in the power of having a valuable company, because I think it gives you options. So sure, you could sell it for a premium, right? Obviously that's the sort of, you know, most obvious option of having a valuable company. But I think there are other options, right? So you can, if you've got a business that doesn't rely on you personally, you can bring in a management team and kick yourself up to the boardroom and just kind of be a shareholder. You can bring in the next generation of managers, right? So your kids or key employees, managers, if you want to do a management buyout. You know, you've got options, but if again, the business is too deeply dependent on you, you're very limited in terms of your options. So I think not getting involved in it soon enough is probably the biggest mistake.
Yeah, that's a great point. You want to come from a position of strength when it's time to figure out what your options are, because a lot of times your plan A might not work out, and you need to know that the business is going to be okay while you restructure and come back with plan B. Now, John, a lot of advisors are now getting into the field of exit planning. When I first started in it, nobody ever heard of it, but now a lot of people are getting into it, and a lot of people are coming aboard with you as certified value builders. What is the biggest mistake that advisors make in approaching owners about hiring them as a coach for this type of a thing?
Probably talking about exit as the primary motivation. I mean, when we talk to entrepreneurs, you know, they are obviously deeply secretive about their intentions of their business. They're nervous about what they will do after they exit their business, what life will be like, how it'll feel. They don't like to be told what to do. So if you've ever been involved in an EO forum or a Vistage forum, you know that one of the language protocols in one of those forums is share experiences, don't give advice, because entrepreneurs, by their very nature, if you think about them as a human being, they don't like authority, right? Like, they've chosen not to go work at IBM for a reason. They don't like to be told what to do. And that's, by definition, you know, their job description. And so as an advisor, I think the last thing you want to do is say, I'm an exit planner and I can teach you how to do an exit. It will fall on deaf ears on so many levels. One, I don't want to be told what to do. Two, I don't want an exit. What I think you want to do instead is say, look, you've been incredibly successful. I can help you sort of vet out or sort of evaluate your next set of options, whether that's to sell or grow to the next stage or bring in a management team. I can be a support to you, a subordinate support to you in helping you evaluate those things. And I think you're hitting many of the buttons. They like control. They like to feel successful. They like to work with people who will support them, but not tell them what to do. So those would be some of my advice for sort of advisors in this space.
Yeah, that's a great point. It really is a great point that these are people that are used to pulling the strings and being the authority. They don't want to be told what to do. Now, I know that for advisors out there that are saying, you know, I have tools for helping people develop an exit plan, but you know, one of the key areas of an exit plan, if you look at it, is the growth and the value and the sustainability of the business, because that's what it's all about. So if an advisor, for instance, says, you know, I really like to find out more about this because I think I can go out and find more business owners who want to do this, and then that will lead them to be a better exit plan and client, how do they do that? How do they get in touch and work with you or find out about that?
Yeah, I think just head over to valuebuildersystem.com. You can also go to valuebuilder.com. They both redirect to the same place. You can take the questionnaire yourself. So you can imagine you were a business owner answering the questions. We'll get in touch with you after the fact. Or you can, on valuebuilder.com, you'll see a link for a section called For Advisors, and you can kind of fill out a form, and we'll get in touch with you that way.
So the beauty of this is it's whether you're listening as an advisor or a business owner, or you're a business owner and you want your advisor to get into this so that you can do this, go to valuebuilder.com and look for the questionnaire and take it. It doesn't take that long to take it, and you'll immediately get back a dashboard that shows you your scores in these areas, and then you'll have access to a report through an advisor. And again, Built to Sell, the book, tremendous bestseller and a tremendous read. Every business owner should read it. It's on Amazon.com. And John, you're such an inspiration to those of us in the field here working with business owners. You give us such great insights, and you build things that we can use with our clients on a regular basis. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Well, thanks, Bill.
I know you're thinking of something. But, you know, it's just a pleasure to have you on the show, John. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been terrific.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Keep the good fight going.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this. So please stay with us.
Hey, everybody. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their three